Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order. Sorry, committee, that I'm just a few minutes late, but I'm sure we'll make up time here shortly. So, committee, today we have a pretty full agenda, and for those in the audience, if you're here for House Bill 3615 or 3624, those are going to be carried over until tomorrow. So if those are the ones you're here for, that is it. And I know there's a couple people here for the public hearing on 3614, and it's my intention to hear that bill last, so it's going to be closer to 5 or 515 on that bill. So if you're here for solely that, I don't want you to sit through this unless you're just totally interested in this committee. So I apologize for anybody.
Can we go, Mr.
Chair? That doesn't apply to committee members. So, I'm glad you guys are on top of things. So with that, committee, I think we will go ahead and proceed with opening a public hearing on House Bill 3610. And up first, we have Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3610 is a very minor technical fix on what was Senate Bill 628 in the last session. Basically, foreclosure procedures in Oregon are non-judicial, and it's about a 120-day procedure. But as I was looking at the bill after being contacted by some constituents, they pointed out that one of the affidavits that's basic to this whole loan modification procedure that was part of Senate Bill 628 states that an affidavit, which is important as a part of that process, could be filed actually after the foreclosure sale takes place, because it says it'll be filed on or before the date the trustee conducts the sale. So you're going to have a sale take place at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they don't actually record the documents until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And there's just something inherently unfair about that. And so this basically says, instead of on or before the date of sale, it would be not later than 5 days before the date of sale. And since it's a 120-day procedure, I couldn't see any reason why you couldn't file and record documents 5 days beforehand. Now, I have been contacted by a couple of lawyers who do this kind of work, and I don't in our law firm, and they said they have no problem with the 5 day, but the problem is that now there's going to be a 5 day for some filings and on or before the date of sale on other kinds of filings, and so it kind of muddies up the water. I talked to Senator Bonamici about this, and who also is an attorney, and this was her bill originally, and she said that she's happy on the Senate side to look at that as far as developing consistency. And I have no problem with that, but to say that we should continue having the ability to file documents that should be looked at either by a seller or a buyer before a foreclosure sale takes place, and those documents may not even be filed till after the sale takes place. There's something fundamentally unfair about that. That's why we'd like to have this passed. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for Representative Richardson? Well, Representative, my long list of questions we already discussed, and I appreciate you meeting me on with this bill, and so I'm not going to take up much of your time. And I appreciate your testimony, at least.
Thank you.
Looking at some of the bills we passed to see if they need tweaked, and I think that's always a good idea for us to review what we've done, because we oftentimes, as you know, need to adjust things. So appreciate the close eye that you have.
Thank you very much.
Up next, I have Sybil Hebb.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. I won't take much of your time, just to echo that from our perspective. Senate Bill 628 was a new law, so we haven't had a whole lot of experience in looking at it, but we have heard of a few examples of cases where the affidavit was filed after the sale on the same date, and we agree with Representative Richardson's description of the issue and think that it would be good to have a window prior to the sale when the by which the affidavit had to be filed so that it can accomplish the purpose for which it was created. So we appreciate your attention to that, and we hope to build that.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Hebb?
Quick question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Sybil. Thanks for coming. Have you run into this, other than examining it, have you run into this with clients through the law, sir?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, as I said, we haven't had that much experience with it. It hasn't been in effect for very long. We have had a couple of examples where we've seen that happen. So I can't say that it's a huge issue, but I think it has the potential to be a concern, and it seems like it's fair to have the requirement achieve its purpose by sort of having it done before the sale goes through. So.
Other questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3610 and open a work session on House Bill 3610. Entertain a motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3610 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3610 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Cindy, would you like to call the roll?
Representative Matthews?
Yes.
Representative Wisnett?
Yes.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative May?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Yes.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3610, having received required votes, is passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3699. Patrick, forgive me, but would you give us a summary of the bill ahead of time?
Sure.
Didn't catch the last one, but...
That's okay, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3699 would allow a partnership or joint venture to offer or submit a bid to perform construction work if the named partner or joint venture is properly licensed and endorsed for work. It designates an operative date of July 1st of 2010 of this year.
Thank you. And committee, this bill came to us very late after review in a work group by some folks on a different bill that we're also considering today, that this was a bill that made an inadvertent change in law would have probably a pretty devastating impact to many of them in the construction industry. It was House Bill 3242 that this committee entertained in 2007. So we got the opportunity to fix this before the effective date of that bill, which is in July 2010, definitely needs to be addressed. So that's sort of a background of why we're dealing with this bill right now, even though it seems a little bit out of our purview. It originally did happen in this committee around licensing, and I thought it good that we could catch it and get it fixed. So with that, I'd like to call up John Rakowitz and Brian Krieg.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, John Rakowitz with Associated General Contractors, Oregon Columbia Chapter. And as the chair and the committee administrator pointed out, this is a technical fix. This was inadvertent, and the fix is this. Under current law, would a joint venture, two or more companies come together, form a joint venture to bid on a project. At the point of bid, one of the contractors must be licensed and meet all the owner protections, including the insurance bonding protections and requirements of the new licensure law. Makes perfect sense to us. Because of inadvertent changes, the best we can tell, nobody intended this to occur. If this bill does not move forward and is not passed, the joint venture itself will have to go out and attempt to seek a license, acquire the bonding and insurance policies necessary to have that license. Why that is so difficult is in the current environment, there are a lot of joint ventures going on. There's very little work. A lot of companies are deciding a week or two or three before a bid date to joint venture. And so it's expensive. It might not be practically possible because it takes a period of time to put all those pieces in place. So we're asking that current law be continued by this. That's all we're doing. There's no change in the law. What currently happens in law is at the moment that you are awarded a contract, a joint venture is, and before you begin your actual construction, you must go out as a joint venture, an independent entity, legal entity, and have licensure meet all those requirements. That makes perfect sense to us. But to attempt to do that pre-bid in order to qualify as a bidder is what is at stake here today. And I want to thank the committee chair and the members of this committee for allowing us to bring it forward. We discovered this sort of slow-mo in the last few weeks. Lawyers started talking. They started talking to CCB. And I want to point out two other things. One is that the CCB, we've done this in conjunction with them. There have been no issues. So we can't, in addition to that, we've asked around in the halls. We can't find anybody opposing this because it was simply inadvertent. So with that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Matthews.
Just one, Chair, and thank you very much. I'm just checking. I see that the effective date is going to be July 1 of 2010.
Correct.
Are we missing anything in between now and July 1, perhaps, in doing that?
No. Our understanding is the law would change July 1, 2010, if okay. You don't take this action, and that's why we made that the effective date.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? I certainly, you know, worry about the impact to the insurance and bonding industry of having that additional money revenues coming in, but they haven't signed up in opposition to the bill, so I think that we'll just figure that they're okay with it.
Yeah, they'll continue to get plenty. The standards have been raised by this committee and the big law, and we agree with those standards. We just don't think it should. It's a question of if you get the work, then you should meet the standards.
Makes perfect sense. Mr. Krieg, did you want to testify real briefly before I release Mr. Rakowitz?
Chair Holvey.
We can help you with any questions that might have come up.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg, and here for the Sheet Metal Contractors Association, the Plumbing Contractors Association. As subcontractors, we're not always in on the joint venture, but sometimes we are. But regardless of that, there's a trickle-down effect of this in that if we don't fix this, the extra costs and red tape, the amount of time, just unnecessary wasted money that would happen in this, it just doesn't help anybody, and especially in this economy. So we really urge you to help us with this technical fix. I think it's a poster child for you about why you're here in February, is to be able to clean up little things where we missed something. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Krieg? Seeing none, I thank you, gentlemen, both, and thank you
both
for bringing this to my attention as well. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3699, and it will be my intention to work this bill tomorrow. With that, committee, I'm going to skip over House Bill 3694. I don't know. Is there anybody signed up on that bill?
Mr. Chair, we just have a work session scheduled for that, so we don't have.
We don't have a sign-up sheet on that one. Thank you for that. So I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3656. Patrick, can you describe to the committee what's before us right now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This measure, House Bill 3656, is the measure that stipulates the interest in real property covered by a trustee is terminated and foreclosed as a person that was given notice of the trustee sale. We heard this on Wednesday the 3rd, and we heard this again on Monday. I'm not sure we heard it on Monday. I think we carried over on Monday. But before us, we have Before us, we have the Dash 3 Amendment. The Dash 3 Amendment makes a few changes, including it replaces the qualification that the second bond or obligation be created within 10 days on or after the note, bond, or other obligation secured by the foreclosed residential trust deed, with a qualification that the second bond or obligation was created on the same day as and used as part of the same purchase or repurchase transaction as the one on which the foreclosure action was taken, and that it be owed to or was originated by the beneficiary or an affiliate of the beneficiary in the foreclosure. It replaces language specifying dates of action on which the measure applies to August 4th, 2009 and the effective date of the measure, respectively. We should have required fiscal and revenue impact statements for the Dash 3 amendments for the committee to take action in your packets, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. Was there a fiscal impact? Can you just report on that for me?
You guys
here.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure where my packet is, but
I have it
in here somewhere. And the bringing it down to the bottom, it says, I'm sorry, thank you for waiting. We have a no expenditure impact on the measure.
Thank you for that. And I guess it'll be my intent to hear from somebody from the financial lobby. I don't see Tim Martinez, who I would have called up, and I dare say that I'm looking for someone. But Paul Cosgrove, I suppose you're it.
We'll have to do.
And to be fair, I don't know if there's anybody on the other side, but let's listen to Paul Cosgrove first.
Mr. Chairman, Chopped Liver here, appearing for you on behalf of the financial lobby. Paul Cosgrove, for the record. The financial lobby is in the same position, all of us together. With the Dash 3s, this bill solves a problem, corrects the technical errors, and we have no objection to the bill. Without it, it had significant problems with the Dash 3. All of our concerns have been remedied. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, I still want to understand a scenario where a person is trying to finance a home and they can get a loan for 80% from a bank, but they cannot afford the 20 that may be offered, and so they go out and make an arrangement with a family member or somebody that they know personally who's willing to cover that 20 percent difference for them, or you know, 10, you know, and then they have it. So they have a loan agreement. That person who makes that loan with the bank is still swept into this process and cannot. I'm just trying to figure out where they are left. Should things go south.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingert, that was the concern we had with the bill before the Dash 3.
Okay.
The Dash 3 only makes the lender choose a single remedy if the lender in both loans is at the same, either at the beginning or at the end. So if you have a bank and then grandma helping you with the down payment, or a credit union and a public agency helping you with down payment assistance, those are not affected by this bill. That's what the Dash 3 does. It protects those. It only affects when it's the bank and a subsidiary of the bank, or the bank itself doing both pieces at the beginning, or owning both pieces at the time of foreclosure.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So grandma's protected.
Correct.
And still has the ability to try to recoup.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, and I appreciate your patience with me on this bill, and I just wanted to try to add a little bit of perhaps clarity for the committee on this, because I tussled with this issue quite a bit, and it seemed to me that I didn't want to impact the seller financing or the relative helping you with a down payment, or frankly in this case a disassociated credit union or something else like that, to be able to still provide second financing in a second position. So, but I did still have the issue with a bank or lending institution that originates both the first and second, and put somebody with, and that to me seems like a single loan product. And at that time, they're giving potentially 100% financing with no equity in it, and then their ability to foreclose and then turn around and also sue on what I consider a single loan product goes against this policy that we're discussing here. So it's a lot, it's drawn back quite a bit more from what our original position was on this bill, but I think it's still an important policy decision, and I appreciate your look at it. Hopefully we addressed some of the problems in it. I did want to point out that there were some questions about the word repurchase in this, and certainly it's the intent that I wanted to put it on the record, is that the repurchase is meant to also mean a refinance. So that is, some people call it a repurchase, some people call it a refinance. So I want to clarify that as well. So that was one other point on that. And I don't know if Sybil Hebb also wanted to testify, or, you know, I'd call her up and give a different perspective than the financial lobby. Appreciate your time, Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While Sybil's coming up, could you clarify for me, so what the financial community now is okay, that if they give an 80 and a 20 loan, that they can only recover the 80% of this foreclosures? That's what the bill's doing.
I'll let the financial lobby speak for themselves. Sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisden, if a single lender makes a loan and then splits it into pieces, we're comfortable that single lender has one remedy or the other, but not both. If two different lenders, whether it be grandma or a different lender, they should each have their choice of remedy, but a single lender should only have one. Frankly, many of us thought that's what the law was before this whole process started. We were surprised that somebody figured out to the contrary. So thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you. Representative Stigler had mentioned, and we have an email that came in from one of her constituents making sure that this was retroactive back, and I see that is, and that's great. My question is, the language was created on the same day. Is that referring to date of origination, or is that referring to date of close? Are we going to create a problem here with closing dates being different if we have two loans starting on the same day but closing on a different? Does that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Matthews, your question makes sense to me. Generally speaking, on either a refinance or on a purchase, they will close on the same date. The loans may be negotiated at different time periods, but the closing always happens at the same point. So I think it's fine.
So created as closing. Thank
yes,
you.
Thank you.
Yeah. That was my understanding too, and that's what we meant by the transaction. The transaction takes place at closing.
And Chair, if I can just say, the lien is not created until it is recorded. That happens at closing. That's always on the same date. So I think it's reasonably clear. Thank you,
Ms. Hebb. Would you like to testify, please?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Excuse me, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. In support of House Bill 3656 with the dash threes, we do appreciate the added protection that this bill will provide, and I think it's a good balance of fairness and protecting individual, completely independent, separate folks, grandma or a friend who may negotiate a secondary loan. They ought to have their own independent remedies, but when loans are sort of packaged together in close association with one another for the dual purpose of negotiating a purchase or a refinance, then we think it's appropriate that they be lumped together in that single remedy with the security of the home as its limit. So we think it's good protection, and it gets at loans that are negotiated in concert, essentially, with one another.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This says, you know, that they're associated, the same institution or an associated institution, not necessarily, as you say, packaged.
Well, packaged may be the wrong word. That's my word and not the language of the statute. But I think the concept is, if lenders are affiliated with one another and they're negotiating loans that will be used together to accomplish a purchase, that's what the bill is getting at, is those joint loans, is what I meant to say.
Follow up.
So you don't read this as saying that they have to be legally associated, in other words, just to use something, First XYZ Bank and First XYZ lending arm of bank?
In my impression, I think that would be a fact-based scenario of how closely connected are these institutions? Are they affiliates? Do they share shareholders? What's their relationship? And how closely were they connected in the making of the loan is what my read on it would be.
Thank you.
Certainly, I think that is a good point. The clarity on the word affiliate, and we are looking at a relatively a broad definition of affiliate here, so that just because one bank has a separate corporation, as a the second lender, they definitely have, a relationship through management and ownership and those sorts of things. And certainly you bring up the question of does affiliate also mean, a broader relationship where a bank, a first lien holder or a first mortgage holder and a second mortgage holder, work together so much just by practice that they offer this as a single loan product. Mm-hmm. I think you raise an interesting point that would be considered a relationship that might fall under this bill as an affiliate.
That would be certainly, excuse me, Chair Holvey, members of the committee, that would certainly be our preference, because we think that that's the goal, the purpose of this protection is where there are sort of joint interests involved, that's what is the purpose of the deficiency judgment protection. We want to clearly exclude mom or pop or mm-hmm. neighbor mm-hmm. Who's making a loan independently of that negotiation with the bank.
Thank you. I know that we do have definitions of affiliate in statute currently, and so that will come up perhaps and may need some further clarity on the other side of this building, but I will point out that affiliate does mean a person. I've just got handed this because legislative counsel happens to be here. So it does mean a person who directly or indirectly through one or more intermediaries controls or is controlled by or is under common control with another person. And that is a pretty broad definition by itself, but what you're speaking of is actually a little bit broader than that, is what I'm hearing.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I would defer to Legislative Council's statutory definition, and I think that if we go down the line and determine that there are people who ought to have been included in this definition and are being excluded, then that could be a separate mm-hmm. issue of consideration, mm-hmm. or perhaps we could do further clarification on the Senate side. But I think the goal of the bill here is to strike a balance between getting at those institutions that are lending together versus leaving protections available for small relatives, families, family members, and others.
Right. Well, I appreciate that conversation. I think that does probably merit a little more conversation, perhaps on the other side of this building. But as we see it now, I think we'll just go ahead with this as it stands. And
certainly.
So I appreciate your testimony. Any further questions of Ms. Hebb? Thank you very much
Thank
for
you.
Your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
With that, committee, we are in work session. Can I have a motion on the dash? I believe it is 3 amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3656.
Representative Riley moves the dash 3 amendment be adopted to House Bill 3656. Discussion? Seeing none. And on this bill, I think on this bill we'll start. I think you may have noticed that I'm starting on one side of the dais and moving to the other side of the dais for, I had some people that want to not always be the first and the last ones to vote. And so on this bill, we'll be starting from Representative Wingard's side, if that's right. Cindy, are you keeping track of that? I love keeping you on your toes. Thank you.
Representative Wingard?
Aye.
Mr.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Prejudice against us for the W.
Aye.
Name.
Representative Krieger?
I think so, yes.
Representative Whitman?
Trying to think as a W, I should always be last. Yes.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3656 having re-
The dash threes are adopted.
How's that? Representative Riley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3656 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Go first.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3656 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Wainwright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you for the work to narrow this bill so that it was targeted at exactly who it was intended to be targeted at. And I believe the committee has produced a very good bill. And I think this is a problem that needs to be solved, and I'm glad that we're solving it. And I'd be very pleased to support this bill today.
Thank you. Comment, Representative Gilliam?
No, I've got a...
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite sure we completely got at who this was intended to yet. I believe that there can be a problem with two separate banks who commonly work together but are not affiliated on loans, and I don't know that that happens. I need to look into that more to see if it actually happens, mm-hmm. but that's the one thing that concerns me. But this is a very good bill, and the way it is now, maybe not perfect, but we never, we may not ever get perfect.
Thank you for that, and it will be my intent, and I hope that you also join in watching this on the Senate side, because I think this discussion will happen on the Senate side around that particular word. So.
I absolutely will, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Seeing no further discussion, Cindy, would you like to call the roll again?
Representative Matthews.
Maybe we should go by age or aye.
We are.
Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3656, having received the required votes, is passed the floor with a due pass recommendation. And it occurs to me that we need to assign a carrier. And while I'm thinking about it, House Bill 3610 previously, I don't believe I have to open a work session, but we will have Representative Richardson carry that on the floor. And so House Bill 3656.
I'd be happy to carry.
Representative Riley, would you like to carry that bill?
I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Riley will carry House Bill 3656. With that, I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3657. Patrick, would you like to give us a brief summary of the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This measure is a measure that prohibits the owner of a foreclosed residential property from neglecting upkeep on the property during periods when the property is vacant. It permits local governments to assess a civil penalty for each day during which the owner fails to remedy the conditions of neglect. Sunsets January 2nd, 2014, and declares an emergency. We take effect upon passage. In your packets, you'll find the Dash 3 Amendment. The Dash 3 Amendment. Some of the provisions of the Dash 3 Amendment were discussed previously. The Dash 3 Amendment would exclude local governments that foreclose on a property. It would specify that owners must contest the assessment within 10 days after the notification of the assessment is provided. And it reduces the maximum civil penalty from $1,000 a day to $150 a day.
Thank you. I don't believe, I'm trying to think if the League of Oregon Cities is in the audience. Don't see them. They previously testified on this bill. So with that committee, I think I just would probably, is there any discussion on the bill?
What was the amendment number?
The dash three amendment to the bill. Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendment dated 2810 to House Bill 3657.
Representative Riley moves the adoption of the dash three minute amendments to House Bill 3657. Discussion?
No idea.
Representative Wingard.
Mr. Chair, I'm still at a loss to understand why we need this bill when local governments are perfectly capable of passing ordinances and some have to do this. I mean, it's not like we're ordering them to do it. We're simply, restating their right to do this if they so choose. I'm really confused, and I also don't understand why we would exempt. I mean, if the theory or the point behind the bill is that we don't like to see properties going to neglect, why the local government that may be taking possession of those local properties should be exempt from the need to upkeep the properties is also still a mystery to me.
Thank you for your comments. I know that I know the League of Oregon Cities expressed an interest for some of their local governments, and certainly it's available to other local governments as well besides cities, that to have another tool to address foreclosed properties outside of their nuisance ordinances. It does provide them a different method for addressing this situation when we have several communities that are indeed more impacted than others by the amount of foreclosed properties in their neighborhoods, and just saw this as an additional tool to help address that situation. Representative Smith.
I raised also the question about exempting cities and counties, and thought enough about it, and here were some of the thoughts that I had. It came to my attention actually when we were in Judiciary Committee and on the metal theft bill, and I noticed there was a provision there that was also specifically exempting cities and municipalities from the definition of the entities that were covered by that, and so that made me think about it more. And here's what I determined. First, I go way back a couple hundred years ago to the 11th Amendment and giving special legal and constitutional status to cities and localities, to public entities, to states. The 11th Amendment doesn't cover municipalities or cities, but nonetheless, our legal tradition has adopted that sort of sovereignty principle and created special status for governmental entities of all sorts with relative consistency. I think that one of the reasons that for that is that there are additional alternative mechanisms to hold public entities accountable. For instance, rulemaking built in, public hearings built in, and elections. Also, because of the lawsuit challenges and the potential feedback loop that can develop if you have an entity, that is responsible for the enforcement, that is also supposed to enforce themselves, which is why we have a police department will have an internal affairs department to make it separate. You can deal with that, but it is something we got to deal with. So I think that without the dash twos, the entity or who enforces the nuisance ordinance would be the owner of the property and the enforcement entity and the one who is supposed to be being investigated. So, with all that said, and I apologize for its length, I at least am very comfortable with that change. I think it's probably the smarter way to go than treating them the same as any other entity.
Thank you. And you're speaking to the dash three amendment, just for the record.
I hear that. I apologize, but I was also trying to respond.
But it also applies to dash two. Thank you. Other discussion. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Smith's argument, and it does give me pause about the relationship between this bill and the municipalities, but that, to me, was a little lofty for the practicalness of what we're trying to address, which is we have more than your normal amount of foreclosed homes, which then creates more of a nuisance. I don't see where I appreciate
your motivation to provide another tool in the toolbox, as we like to say around here, but I don't see how it does. I also appreciate reducing the fee from what I think was ridiculous. But I can't support this bill, particularly in this session, and it just doesn't ring true for me, and I don't see the need for it.
Thank you for the comment. Representative Wisnett, did you care to comment?
Question, Mr. Chair. Who brought forth the Dash 3, and what was the justification for going from 1,000 to 150?
Let me see if I remember. I think it was myself and the League of Oregon Cities in conversation that brought the Dash 3 forward.
Thank you.
They also felt the original bill, and I agreed, was the penalty in it was pretty high and didn't really seem fit. And, you know, part of the I guess, motivation of the $150 a day is you could probably hire somebody to help clean up the property for cheaper than that. So,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Krieger.
I kind of remember. After they're notified about the delinquency of the property, what's the time frame that they have to correct it? In other words, a bank forecloses, takes possession of the property, and it's in horrible condition. I can't recall.
I recollection is 30.
I don't know if legislative counsel happens to be here. Maybe he can answer that question so I don't make a mistake.
Recall.
We're guessing 30 days, but I'm not sure I want to go on the record on as a matter of fact.
Representative Hovey, Sean Brennan from legislative counsel. As I recall, it is 30 days. I don't, unfortunately, have the Dash 3s with me for this bill, but as I recall, the structure was that the local government will give notice to the affected property owner. At that time, they'll specify a time which they have during which they have to clean up the actual remedy, the particular nuisance condition. That has to be at least 30 days, and then after that point, they are able to then issue a notice of civil penalty, or actually assess the civil penalty at that point.
Yes.
Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, just further expand, reading in the bill online, on page 2, line 14, it says, well, let's take it from 13. Before assessing civil penalty under the section, local government shall allow an owner not less than 30 days to remedy conditions of neglect that form the basis of determination, right, unless local government makes determination under paragraph of the subsection, and then provide the owner with an opportunity to contest the assessment at a hearing.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah. Thank you for that clarity. Representative Wingard.
Just one final thought, Mr. Chair. You know, as all of our different levels of government have grown large and become a much more significant presence in our lives, there is a great deal of resentment that has grown up within the population when the government gets special treatment that everybody else outside of government doesn't get, when they're essentially exempted from fines or rules or expectations that others are expected to follow. And again, to these Dash 3s, you're going to have scenarios where the city or county has taken possession of a property and a neighbor is really unhappy with the upkeep, and they're going to find that if some private person owned it, they're, you know, the city would go to bat to find the person to put it in order, and in this case the city or county itself owns it, and I'm not sure that the next election cycle is really the remedy that they're looking for at that point. And it just adds again to that frustration that they will ask at that time, why is my government getting the exception to this rule?
Certainly I appreciate your position, obviously, I don't quite agree with you. I think Representative Smith sort of laid out the scenario pretty well, and I think that, local government, to fine the local government, sort of like the taxpayers fining themselves, and certainly I think our local governments have the ability to be held accountable by the public, as Representative Smith has laid out, and certainly the neighbors that could be impacted by this situation don't have that same sort of recourse on private entities. So I think there is a difference, and I'm comfortable with moving this bill forward at this point. Representative Smith.
I have a comment to respond to that, but if we're still talking about the dash threes, I'd be happy to defer until we're talking about the dash twos, if there's going to be further discussion.
We are not going to, are we moving the dash twos?
Mr. Chair, the dash twos are replaced by the dash threes.
Yes, yes. Gotcha. Okay, so yeah. I do, one quick comment.
Certainly.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Wingard in an important point, and that is that we need to hold government to at least as high a standard as we hold private enterprise. I think it's a really important point, and I want to say for the legislative record that, and to Scott Winkles if he's in the room, that if there is a practice where we have municipalities who are behaving poorly in this regard, then even if this isn't the best body to address it, I think we should anyway. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is it isn't that, in my view, we should hold government to a lesser standard. Quite the contrary. It is that if in a bill like this they are included in the same way, their inclusion is a fiction because it is the fox guarding the hen house, and we need a different set of mechanisms to hold them accountable. And they should have the same expectation but with different tools. But I again want to say for the record that if there is a problem demonstrated by public entities in this arena, I very much hope that there will be bipartisan support to do something about it soon.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments.
Mr. Chair. I will be a no until I hear from my cities. I have not heard any complaint in my issue. I appreciate Representative Stegler's had an issue in Bend, but I still don't see anything in the city of Bend. So I'll be a no until I hear from my cities that they need help in doing this.
Certainly. I can appreciate that. Any other comments? Cindy, would you? I have a motion to adopt the dash threes on the table still. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Could you please call the roll?
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Yes. Representative
Wisnett? Yes.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
No.
Representative
Chair
Gilliam.
No.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Wolby.
Chair votes aye. Dash three amendments having received required votes are adopted to House Bill 3657.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 3657 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3657 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I think we've already had our discussion. Oh, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my final thought on this is I'm just sitting here musing and wishing, maybe it's very naive, but wishing that in this economy we could somehow take a different role or a different tact. Where's the carrot instead of the stick? Maybe you need the stick to make sure these places get cleaned up. But with our focus that we've all agreed on jobs, wouldn't it be nice if there was an opportunity here for folks to go to work fixing, cleaning up nuisance homes in some mechanism to encourage them instead of the stick? That's all I just did.
Thank you. I think this mechanism may, in fact, create some jobs, quite frankly. And, I think it's important to note that, many of our communities are at risk of losing value in their neighborhoods when these situations are not addressed. And that's largely the impetus for this bill. Is to help local governments ensure that the values of our neighborhoods don't unnecessarily decrease because the owners of foreclosed properties decide not to keep them up and make a small investment to make sure they are staying in good repair. So that's my final comment to yours.
Representative Smith.
For the legislative record, I just want to make really clear to courts and implementers that reasonable maintenance is all, you know, all is being asked for by the bill, at least as far as my vote goes, and the and not asking for significant investment or improvement, but just to keep houses from getting a lot worse.
Thank you. With that, I have a motion on the floor. Cindy, could you read the roll call again?
Representative Winger?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
No.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
No.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3657, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I was going to assign this to Representative Fredericks. Next up, we have House Bill, where the heck are we? 3689. Still thinking about it. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3689. Patrick, can you give me a brief summary of the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try to be brief. House Bill 3689 is our pay-twice construction lien bill, which we've heard several times. This bill, I believe the -5 amendment, which we have before us now, would modify the original bill by clarifying language on when material suppliers must check license status of subcontractors. It modifies Section 4 to apply to persons who provide labor in addition to the others. It also replaces the term mechanics lien. Oh, I'm sorry. I believe I have left something in there that doesn't apply. This deletes the statutory lien waiver sample forms in Section 4 rather than modifying them. It deletes provisions limiting maximum required deposits. It authorizes the Construction Contractors Board to place a contractor on probation if the contractor accepts a deposit of more than 50% and fails to perform the improvement diligently and in accordance with the contract specifications which contractor received the deposit, or if the contractor fails to perform the improvement and fails to return the deposit within 10 days.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, I notice you're in the crowd. Would you like to come up and just give us a once-over on the bill and maybe answer any questions that might come up about this bill? I will tell the committee that the lien waiver form, which was previously in the bill, we did have a disagreement amongst some of the members of the state bar on that lien waiver form, and so I opted to remove that from the bill. And I think there's general agreement on the other pieces that are left in the bill from the industry, and certainly I haven't heard any opposition to it. So thank you, Mr. Smith. Maybe you could just walk us through just a little bit more in detail than what Patrick just did for us, if you would be so kind.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. Before you is the -5 amendments. It really does three substantive things that the previous original bill, that's three things that are still left in there. The first one is that it provides for new home buyers and sellers a requirement that they pick some meaningful protection for that home seller. Heretofore, the current law allowed the parties to waive that one of those protections. So this would lock that down. It also provides an extension of a prohibition for subcontractors and includes now material dealers an inability to file a lien if materials that are purchased or installed were installed by contractors that were not properly licensed at the point of time that the products were sold or installed. We think that's a real good idea. There's a provision in the bill that would allow the agency to charge a small fee to material dealers if they wish to engage in a process that we have for construction contractors, a thing we called eWatch. It's a e-mail based system that is really used by primary contractors to keep track of their subcontractors, make sure they're licensed. This would be an optional program for them. They would not be required. They don't have to be involved with that. But material dealers would have an interest to make sure that at the time they sold materials to contractors, that those folks were properly licensed, and this service would help them. In the alternative, they could check our website, and they could do that for free. They have been doing that for some time, and, of course, that ability would remain. There also is the change in policy here dealing with down payments. You remember there was some, the previous bill spoke with down payments. Here, what this bill would do would allow your contractor's board to put a contractor on probation if that contractor had a large down payment of 50% or more and then didn't diligently perform the work or didn't do the work at all and refused to give the money back. That probation could be an opportunity for the agency to talk to the contractor, might have the contractor take some more education classes, but in any event would put the contractor on notice that we're watching that person and with an eye to make sure that they don't get in trouble, particularly with large down payments. The last part of the bill, as I understand it, with the Dash 5 amendments continue in Section 8 to talk about retainage. As I remember Jeremy Vermillion's testimony from last time, and I'm not an expert in this area, that part of the bill does not change the retainage. That was merely some cleanup, and that was offered by Mr. Vermillion and other lawyers that worked with him. That's a summary of the bill, Dash 5, as I understand it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions, if you will indulge me. Craig, how much is the fee?
Chair Holvey and Representative Wingert, we've estimated a fee of no more than $5 a month, perhaps $50 a year, $50 or $60 a year. And again, the only reason for that fee is to generate sufficient revenue to rework our IT system so that somebody who currently isn't involved in paying for it, i.e. the material dealers, an opportunity to provide some revenue that would allow for that IT service.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Second, this issue about the probation, help me understand whether or not this is really even useful. I mean, in most cases where the homeowner is screwed, the guy or gal who ran the operation has gone under or is gone. So, I mean, I'm trying to figure out if the idea of putting a bad actor on probation is really even a useful mechanism. I mean, how many people end up in these situations where they have to twice pay and the person who screwed it up is actually still in business and sanctionable?
Yeah. Chair Holvey and Representative Wingard, I think that your observation is a fair one. I think there would be a very small amount of folks that would still be in business, but we have heard of them. We've had a recent case, really it's gone on now for some period of time, where a repair contractor took significant down payments, didn't do the work. There was some issue about whether or not the contract allowed for that large down payment. That was being solved in our dispute resolution process. But the practical problem for our end was that it appeared as though that contractor was taking large payments, and we had a difficult time doing much about it on our dispute resolution end because of the way the contract was structured between the parties. And if we had this authority, if you chose to allow this, that might provide us a tool in that case.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Two more questions. With this idea of requiring the homeowners to take some kind of protection, at the end of the day, in your opinion, does this bill make new homes more expensive or less expensive?
Chair Holvey and Representative Wingert, in the past when I've answered such questions, I've put myself in a bit of a box.
You're welcome.
So with your permission, I'll suggest that that would be a policy issue, and I don't have a solid opinion on the matter.
Okay. Final question, Mr. Chair. We have been dealing with this issue, I mean, it predates me, it may even predate my birth, but we were certainly dealing with this in the last session, and had the committee had unanimously focused on a solution that I think, if we could describe it in one word, was elegant. in its simplicity. So my final question for you is that by passing this bill, will we be taking this whole area of construction contract law and making it more complicated or less complicated?
Chair Holvey and Representative Wingert, you know, any time that you add additional statutes, you're not simplifying the matter. I think there's an interesting part of this bill where in one case you are eliminating, and that's in the Home Buyer Protection Act, where you're taking out that possibility of the parties waiving the protection. So you're reducing statutes a little bit there. But I think it is fair to say that in this complicated society, the laws that you would be enacting with this bill would make the statutory scheme slightly more complicated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Craig. I'm going to give the opportunity to the AGC and Mr. Rakowitz and Mr. Krieg to comment on the bill as well, since I don't have anybody up here to comment on the amendments, if they so wish. If they don't, they don't need to. I don't see anybody jumping up. They're not excited about it. No comments. Okay. They seem to be okay, and I do know that I did receive an email yesterday that did have a little bit of concern with some tech, you know, some semantics and a little bit of language in one part, in section 3 of the bill, and so I'm going to put them in contact with the certifiable smart people that have been working on this, including yourself. To see if there's an issue there that does need to be addressed on the other side of this building. I'm not sure there really is. Maybe just some clarification is all that's needed. So I just wanted to put that on the record too. So I appreciate your time. I know I share Representative Wingard's frustration with us not to be elegantly solving this problem, but I think these particular steps in the bill, though they do not solve the original problem that this committee faced of the pay-twice situation where consumers end up having to pay for things twice, I think this bill does go a little ways towards preventing those things from happening as much as they do. And I think that all that have been involved in this 6 or 7 month work group on this will share that opinion as well, although I'm not speaking for them directly. That was the indication that I got from those that were involved in this conversation. So I think it is a step in the right direction, though it does maybe provide a little bit of complication for the industry. They operate already in a pretty complicated world, and they're used to this. And so with that, I think it still is a good move forward for consumers. So thank you very much for your testimony. So have we moved? Have we got a motion?
We don't have a motion.
Oh. Yeah, we are. Could we have a motion on the Dash 5 amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 3689, dated 2810.
Representative Rowley moves the Dash 5 amendments be adopted to House Bill 3689. Discussion? Not seeing any discussion. Cindy, would you like to call the roll again?
Representative Wingert?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
I'm not sure if you voted for me or not. The chair votes aye. House Bill, or the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3689 are adopted.
Vice Chair, I move House Bill 3689 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3689 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Wingert.
for the audience listening across the state and anyone who might be thinking about running or serving at some point, this is a pretty good example of why this job can be extremely frustrating and disheartening over time and can wear you down. It remains frustrating that a problem that cries out for a solution that admittedly does not impact a large number of Oregonians, but when it does hit them, is devastating and extremely hurtful, and it goes unsolved. And everybody's intentions are, I'm sure, fantastic. And in our effort to turn the wheels of government and the process to solve this problem, we have not only not solved it, but at the end of the day, we're going to make the law more complicated in this process. And and yet we're going to congratulate ourselves and go forth. And I'm sure this subject will come back to us. I will be supporting the bill for reasons that I can no longer explain.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say I almost entirely agree with Representative Wingard. The only part I disagree on is I think that this is a small step forward. And a small step forward is better than no step or a step backward. I think that we, frankly, did much better last session in this committee, but it didn't get out, so we're where we are, and we're making small steps, but we are making small steps forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After this vote, I would like a vote on this by this committee, of those that believe anybody's listening out there.
You're going to get emails.
Yeah.
Care about me.
Representative Gilliam, that would be out of order.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I will be voting no. I'd like to get some more information from my district, and I may change my vote on the floor.
Certainly your prerogative. Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, just in light of some of the comments, I just want to say that this has been an issue, and as Representative Wingard had said, that when it hits people, it hits them pretty hard, but it's one that when you vet this in your town halls, when you talk to your communities and you tell people that they're vulnerable to be in this situation, they listen because they don't realize that. So we make a little bit light of it because of our frustration here, but just so you know, we are addressing a problem, and I'm happy to report that we're addressing the problem in a manner that I think is responsible. We've gotten the parties together that are affected, that will be implementing this, that are impacted, and we've also talked to our citizens about this. This is an issue that certainly isn't going to be a campaign championship winner, but at the end of the day, whether you congratulate yourself or not, we at least know we took a step in the right direction, which is what this is supposed to be about, consumer protection. So I'll be supporting the bill. I support the effort, and I thank all those involved that participated in this process to get us moving in the right direction and protect people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and you probably trumped me on my thanks to some very smart people across this state who worked for months on this particular issue. And it may seem like a small step, but these are major policy changes that will have a positive impact for consumers. Albeit it may be in a limited few cases, but they are still very important to those that get in these positions. I too share the frustration that we weren't able to solve this problem, but it is an extremely complicated issue, and we do live, as the Chair Craig Smith pointed out, in a pretty complicated arena of business, and the industry, you know, stepped up and talked about it. We vetted it. The bill that we passed last session seemed very elegant, seemed very simple and straightforward. But it obviously did not, even though it made it across the House with very few no votes, it was pointed out on the Senate side that there was potentially some pretty major impacts to the industry. And I agreed at that point to take another look at this and try to mitigate, you know, some perhaps economic impacts that we would have suffered had that gone forward. Though it would have been elegantly protecting consumers, it may have damaged many in the industry and some potentially some jobs. So I take no regret in continuing on this effort to look at this issue, and I am not saying that I'm done looking at this issue, but it does take a lot of discussion, and I do want to particularly thank Jeremy Vermilia and Alan Mitchell and Eric Grassberger, the Construction Contractors Board, and the State Bar, actually, you know, for engaging us in talking about this issue. So I think that's probably enough thanks to go around, and the industry, of course, as well, and the consumer groups that also stepped up. So with that, have we voted yet?
We haven't passed the bill yet.
Oh.
No.
But congratulations.
So
too many hallmark
moments. Do we have a motion on the floor?
We do have a motion, Mr. Chair. Representative Riley needs a motion.
Okay, can we have a roll call?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3689. Having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a new pass recommendation. I suppose I'll try to carry this one. Mm-hmm. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3689 and open a work session on House Bill 3694. Sorry, gone just a little bit out of order there. Patrick, would you give us a small summary of House Bill 3694?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill we heard on Monday. This authorized residential landlords to continue to use or to revert to using a separately charged pro rata apportionment billing method for water or sewer services if such a billing method is used for tenants on the premises immediately before a statutory change that restricted the use. It has an emergency clause. We have in the packets a Dash 1 amendment, which we adopted, Mr. Chair, at the last meeting. We adopted the Dash 1. That amendment clarifies that a pro rata apportionment billing arrangement must be charged separately for all tenants. It changes the bill language referencing tenants in the premises to tenants in the facility, and then deletes the changes that the original bill would have made to ORS 90.532, subsection 3. And the reason we did not move the bill, Mr. Chair, at the last meeting, is my understanding, is because we did not have the fiscal impact statement you have in your packets, the fiscal impact statement for this bill now, which I think is a no fiscal impact or a minimum.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3694.
As amended?
As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3694 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, would you like to call the roll?
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Krieger? Aye.
Representative
Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative
Matthews? Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
The Vice Chair votes aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3689, having received the required... House Bill 3694, having received the required votes, is passed the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah.
Volunteer to carry the bill?
I will.
Representative Tomei. Thank you.
You're welcome.
With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3694. Up next, committee, we have a public hearing scheduled on House Bill 3614, and I know I... I'm amazed at our timing on this, that I and that this is Representative Thatcher's bill, and I had instructed her or told her that I thought it would be about 5:30 before we got to this, and had permission to run our committee late That has doesn't appear that it will be necessary, and so I don't know if Representative Thatcher wants to wait till 5:30 now. She does not, and so with that, I'd like to open a well, I'm going to stand at ease for just a moment, just recess for a few minutes. I need a drink of water.
like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection back into order.
Is Representative Mesa all right? Did you see
her? She wasn't out.
No.
She may have been
Okay. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3614. Patrick, would you give us a brief summary of the bill?
I certainly will, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3614 establishes the Task Force on Core Functions of Government. It outlines the purpose of the task force, membership of the task force, sunsets the task force on the convening of the 2011 Legislative Assembly. It would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. You have in your packet the Dash 1 Amendment, which I believe was also brought by the bill's sponsor. That amendment would reduce the total membership of the task force from 11 to 10 members, would reduce from 4 to 2 the number of members appointed by each, or from 4 to 2 the numbers appointed by the Speaker of the House and Senate President. It would increase from 1 to 4 the number of members appointed by the task force who are not public officials. And it would add outcomes and priorities upon which budgetary decisions are to be made. It replaces the list of suggested recommendations, adds authority of the task force to establish advisory groups, directs the Department of Administrative Services to post the task force information and recommendations on the Oregon Transparency website.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher. Good afternoon. I'm glad I didn't have to make you wait till 5:30.
Me too, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, representing District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And I hope that this isn't the only bill between you and the door. Oh, geez.
Yeah.
That's a tough. Okay, well, I also want to thank you for staying here. I might have a couple people who have come from different parts of the state to testify, and I appreciate you staying. Also want to thank Representative Jefferson Smith for helping make what I think is a good bill even better, and we're working together. I mean, only good things can happen when we're working together, right, Representative? We've just heard the latest revenue forecast, not so rosy. Wasn't so good. It was not as shocking as the forecast we've had in the recent past, but you consider that in conjunction with the fact that we used billions of dollars of one-time money, over $1 billion in one-time money, last session to plug budget holes. We're going to be facing some hard times. I believe it's going to be tough next session, and we're going to have to reckon with reality and not continue business as usual. In other words, we need to focus on spending on the priorities. In 2002, the state of Washington was facing a gap in their budget to the tune of billions of dollars, and they decided to adopt an innovative budget process. They were able to work through their budget without raising taxes, that appeals to me, while protecting priority or vital services. And I think that should be something that could bring us all together. Imagine opening up the Oregonian and reading this. Few Oregonians will find much to like about the brutal state spending plan the legislature recommended, but as ugly as the result was, there's a lot to like about the way the legislature and staff arrived at it, using a new process that forced hard choices about the core priorities of state government. I basically took an excerpt from the Tacoma News Tribune where they talked about Washingtonians and the process that was adopted there. In reading a book, if you haven't read it yet, it's very good. It's called The Price of Government. They talked about how the legislature in Washington even liked the new budget format. The finance director there said, "It was astounding. I've never been to a set of hearings where the reception was so positive despite the amount of bad news we had to deliver." Because they could see that a process, a transparent, straightforward process was put in place, and it made sure that priorities were protected. In this case, the budget was framed around 10 core objectives. All programs and agency activities were listed in order of importance in meeting those objectives. The budget process was clear and was transparent to both the legislators and the public. Now, I talked a little bit about this bill not too long ago, but I was going to go into more little more detail this time. It's called Core Functions of Government, Establishing a Core Functions of Government. But if you picture yourself holding a government thesaurus in your hand, you might also see next to it the term budgeting for outcomes or core services of government or priorities of government. They're all kind of on the same line. This week's revenue forecast is a good reminder of why we need to start prioritizing our spending in a different way, focusing on the outcomes rather than just keeping on doing what we've been doing and adding some money to it. This process, we can both spend more money and cut services, cut programs all at the same time. It's kind of a chaotic system. If you have a little green handout, I'm hoping you have that. Okay, good. On this side, talks about the budget emphasis. If the budget emphasis is on cost, which is basically what we have right now, we have hundreds of agencies, and then we add in inflation and caseload increases and arrive at a new budget, regardless of how much money we really have to spend. Whereas changing it to what outcomes, what value, what results are we looking for, and these are the core principles, making sure that the agencies and the programs and the activities each of those entail, do they advance the core principles? If they don't, then they go below the line. That way we can prioritize, keep the vital services going, and balance within the existing budget. There's a lot of discussion about you either have to raise taxes or you have to cut programs, and I really think that this is a third way, and I think it deserves some serious consideration. And we would start with what I'm suggesting in the bill, which is to determine the core functions of government. What's of most value to the public? Determining the set of priorities of government, and then budgeting to that. On the other side of your handout is a sort of a pyramid, and I wasn't sure what geometric shape to use, because really the core functions of state government, this is what's important to the citizens of the state. So maybe that should have been the foundation, but really that's where it is generated. These are the core functions. We can, for example, you start by saying that a core function of government is to keep the public safe from criminals. Okay, then you would turn to the Oregon benchmarks and then run it past the key performance measures to see if the results are being measured properly. And all that information would filter down to the Ways and Means Committee, who sets the budget. And eventually the money goes out to the state agencies who purchase the government services to support the core functions. It all ties together. We are doing a number of things here in Oregon. This just connects the dots between some of the initiatives that we've already put in place. There are a number of states who have used it. The one state that I think had the best example of how it could work is in Washington, and they have a very good website. Makes the process very transparent about what comes first, who serves, how things are determined. And in discussions with Victor Moore up in Washington, he's a state budget director for Governor Gregoire, he was not able to testify because the rules would not permit. But if you do have individual questions, I'm sure he might answer you. And there's also a very good website, and I can give that information to you if you're interested. But on they call it Priorities of Government website, in Washington State, they said this in their overview. This is a top-down approach to the budget, which starts with statewide results rather than agency budget requests. State activities need to prove their effectiveness in achieving statewide results and strategies before they deserve inclusion into the budget. I think we can do something and put our Oregon brand on it and run with it.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing this forward. It's a big topic. There's no doubt about that. I really applaud your interest in this and you moving this conversation forward. I don't know for sure, you know, how much we have done in this state already and how much we are currently working on already, and I believe this conversation needs to continue for sure. And I commit that this committee is going to continue to work on this going forward as well. And so I hope we can keep you engaged in this conversation. But from my perspective, sitting here right now, I know that the legislature has passed several bills in the past, you know, all addressing different pieces of a lot of the things that you are describing, you know, and I will mention just a few. I know members may have received House Bill 5002, which is a service and policy function review, which is looking at the core functions of government in Department of Administrative Services, for one. And I know Representative Nathanson has passed last session House Bill 2920 on cost-efficient service delivery, looking at that. And we also passed House Bill 2500, which we now have implemented the transparency website, which is, I think, a pretty good start so far on the transparency side. It's, I think they're doing an excellent job of getting that up and running. You know, and we have, you know, several other House Bill 2867 looking at the procurement processes, and House Bill 3139 on internal auditing and governance assessments. The governor has done some work in this area as well with the Reset Executive Order, regulatory streamlining, and his sustainability efforts as well. And we have a committee on performance excellence that's being done by all state agencies, and that was directed by Senate Bill 1099. And we've got a lot of things that, you know, are all touching this same subject matter, and I could probably go on for a little bit. I've got a huge list of things that are currently working on, and we did have the Oregon Progress Board until we unfunded it because we just didn't have the revenue to keep it going. And so, you know, there's a lot of work going on. And so, from my standpoint, Representative Thatcher, I really like this concept that you're bringing forward. But I think this committee needs to sort of take a look at this issue in a much broader and a much more in-depth than we probably have time to do. And I know that's the purpose of your bill, is to create a task force to do just that. My concerns with doing that and doing that is not only perhaps the fiscal requirements of doing that, but also not really knowing that we've probably got a lot of other pieces out there that are already doing several pieces of this. So I think we really need to identify, you know, what we are doing as a committee, since we have the government accountability piece of this committee, and I think we can accomplish that and come back with a real good look at, you know, just where do we need to go next, because I'm a little hesitant to layer on yet another requirement, another bill on agencies that is somewhat going to be redundant. And so I'm just hesitant to do that when we've got all these other pieces. And I know that you may disagree with me about that, as in our past conversations, but I certainly think this particular issue does need a much, much closer look by the legislature, so that the legislature really does understand what our state government is doing about identifying their core functions and how they, you know, prioritize. Much of that, I think, though, is also accomplished through the Ways and Means process of prioritizing what we do, and we all vote on that. And certainly we have to do that every couple of years, and it's difficult for us, I think, to set priorities about how we're going to spend our money and commit to the next legislative assembly that that's what they will do. As you know, we can't do that, actually. The next legislative assembly has the ability and authority to again go through the process and set their own priorities for which they spend their money, and so spend, you know, the tax revenues and whatnot for the services that they deem, you know, to be the priorities at that legislature. And we can't really bind them in the future to determine what those are. But I think, you know, this does deserve a lot closer look. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. And I wanted to have that conversation on, you know, right here, right now, to just ensure that this committee will be looking at this issue through the interim and working on this, and maybe we will come back with another look at core functions and figure out, you know, how to do that. But I don't feel I'm comfortable moving your bill, but I think it's a great conversation to have, and it's a great task for this committee to take on. And I think we can accomplish that without a task force. So that's my perspective, but I want to make sure that we have other people that get a chance to testify on this, because I know there's some that are signed up.
Can I just clarify a couple of things, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Thank you. We are doing a number of things here in Oregon, and I think this helps connect the dots,
mm-hmm.
actually, between those things. They're kind of siloed right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are some initiatives over here, something over here, and I think this helps in a way create a mission statement. This is what the state of Oregon wants to do, and everything needs to go to that. And so, and then there's this would be advisory, completely advisory. Of course, we would, as a legislative body, it would behoove us to make the final decisions and make any changes that are pertinent. But these, I think, absolutely. I'm glad that you're committing to continuing the conversation, and I think it's timely because we're going to be facing some really hard times next time, but better late than never, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Krieger, I think.
Not really a question, I don't think, but back in 2002, we had the downturn going to three at five special sessions, and we had, and again, even coming in a year ago in January, we had probably 50, 60 special interest groups come in, education, seniors, veterans, county health, public safety. Gee, protect mine. I can't take a 2% cut or 3% cut. Take it over there. So I had a pie, and it had all the different parts where the budget's going. I says, well, if you don't want to take any, do you want me to cut the seniors? Do you want me to cut education? Once they had to make the decision to remain untouched, they had to make the decision who they were going to take the money from. I didn't get a one of them to tell me where I should take the money. It isn't easy. And we've been doing, I've been here fifth session, I'm going to probably do this crazy thing again here. That means I'll be back in 2011, and I know what we're looking at. It's scarier than before. And I think that this would be a heck of a tool to have a group starting the process. And, you know, you talk about a task force is going to cost money. How many task forces did we do last session and the session before? And I looked at some of them. I wasn't really certain what they were for. But this one, to me, would have been a priority.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I was out when you were on some of the comments. But I detected you're saying that you don't plan to move this bill, and I think it's a big mistake, respectively, to the chair. I think it's the right thing to do, and I'm glad to see Representative Smith step up and agree to work with Representative Thatcher. I worked on a task force for the last 6 months on resort bills, which you know I strongly opposed that legislation in the last session, and I endorsed the legislation that came out of that task force, and I think this is the committee that should be looking at government accountability. And I think the chair could provide the leadership. I worked my first session in this building. I was on the full Ways and Means Committee, and we had great presentations. We started the key performance measure in our budget process, and I think there's a step before that that you have to do it. And I think the Representative Thatcher has identified that for us, and I would really urge the chair to reconsider and to move approve a task force bill. I mean, we do it every day, and I think it can be done about costs. So I had the honor of working with Representative Smith and Representative Thatcher on the 2500 bill, and we passed the transparency bill at no cost to the state, the citizens of Oregon, because we had dedicated state employees. And I think some state employees in fiscal and revenue would step forward and work on this project with legislators too. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Wingard, I do want to note that I do have some other folks that signed up that want to testify from the public. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that I am not aware of any effort around this issue that is going to be conducted in a bipartisan fashion with the intent of trying to get people across the spectrum to come together and agree on some basic principles and talk about prioritization. And I want to echo what Representative Wisnett said about this being an opportunity that we can seize on now in this special session, which I think some people have been groping around for a real explanation for why we're having a special session. There is actually an opportunity here. No matter who the majority party is in the next session, the entire body, including the leadership, is going to face some very, very unpleasant circumstances when it comes to how much money there is versus the demand for services. And cuts are going to have to be made, and they're going to be unpleasant for a lot of people. They're probably going to be rather wide-ranging. And there is an opportunity in Representative Thatcher's and Representative Smith's idea here to start a conversation, a bipartisan conversation, about how to enter that session in a way that we might survive it. And still be able to shake each other's hands and hang out together and be able to maybe as a group face the public and say, we had a plan coming in as to how we were going to tackle these very difficult situations, and we executed that plan. The alternative is kind of what we've done in the past, which is to really not want to admit what we're facing coming into a session, pretend it's not really happening, and then ultimately, once it's on us, have some very, very stark decisions to be made, not necessarily with a lot of information. People in a very short period of time trying to make those decisions that are going to affect a lot of people, and then a whole bunch of fighting going on because there was never really a conversation about how we would... No emergency plan, essentially, about what you do in declining revenue situation. So, again, I would say that there is an opportunity here to start a conversation that would last almost a year and could put us in a position as a 91-member body. I'm including the governor, and we're going to have a new governor. A 91-member body to have a plan, a blueprint about how we're going to tackle a situation where we have this much in revenues and this much in demand.
Certainly, I appreciate your comments. I do note that all of these efforts that are being made around statewide performance management and the House Bill 5002 work group are bipartisan. Representative Dennis Richardson is on that, along with Representative Nancy Nathanson. This committee is a bipartisan effort, and we'll continue to talk about it. The Ways and Means process works on these issues year-round, and there are members from both parties on that essentially does look at those budget things and does plan ahead about how we're going to face these crises. I certainly don't discount the importance of this committee to weigh in on that, and we fully intend to do that as a committee. And I believe that is our charge in this committee, and I intend to go down that road. And I appreciate everybody's sentiment on that. But I do know that we have a lot of agencies that have been directed to do many of the things that that are already ongoing, and we need to bring those back to this committee, I believe, to get a fuller understanding of all those pieces and move forward from there as a committee with members from both parties on it. And that is my intent, and I think it is a needed thing. I'm not discounting the importance of it at all. I suppose have a different point of view on how we get there, as opposed to a task force, which I think I want to have a more direct role of the legislature actually doing this. We have the Secretary of State's office that does audits and performance evaluations. We have the governor's office doing the same thing. We have, all the agencies have been directed by statute to conduct different parts of what's contained in this bill. And I think this committee itself needs to understand all those different pieces that are happening today, because they are happening, and reevaluate this, and hopefully we can do that over the interim and have something to offer to the next legislative assembly on this issue. That is my goal. I think it's a prudent way to approach this at this point, so I appreciate that. I really would like to get on with some more testimony, though, and Representative Smith, you keep raising your hand, and I don't see you on the sign-up sheet. Would you like to testify on this?
I would love to testify.
Oh, certainly. Would you like to?
Here, there.
Certainly.
Stay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jefferson Smith, representing District 47. I was proud to work with Representative Thatcher and Representative Wisnant on 2500, the transparency bill. I'm happy to and proud to testify and work on this. Whether we are those who are generally frustrated by the government or even its notion, or those who are more hopeful about the role that government can play, we can at least, I hope, agree that government should be improved, and that we should consistently improve our public structures, not just for bigger or smaller government, but for better government. Credit here, I think, goes to Representative Thatcher, her aide Don Phillips, and also to my aide Alex Tinker, who worked with them on concepts and amendments. Also to the chair for being willing to have this hearing, and appreciate it. I know that the evening is late, and your willingness to have the hearing go long in order to start this conversation, at least, is valuable. I think there are some important elements here to pursue, either through this bill or in the future, to determine how we should focus our work and deliver great service in our areas of focus. A few concerns that I've heard that I want to respond to. Sort of maybe a cluster of them. The Ways and Means Committee should set priorities distinct from a task force. I think it's a legitimate concern. Also, the efforts that are already underway and how this would overlay with those. I think that is a legitimate concern. We do, however, I think, need to improve our key performance measures and the process by which we come up with them. I don't know if anybody else here, who else here sits on a Ways and Means Subcommittee and sees the list that comes to us to address our key performance measures, but I think that, but I've heard from people in other states that we are still sort of a baby state in figuring out how we do those better and measure our success better. I think, second, in response to that, there is a role for multiple branches of government here. The governor, as a manager of a large set of institutions, is going to be engaged in our government efficiency efforts. The legislature, as a wielder of the purse power and the setter of budgets, will play a role in government efficiency efforts. The Secretary of State, as the auditor of those agencies, will play a role. Ironically, our efforts at improved government efficiency will be, by their very nature, ironically multilateral and sometimes tangled and confused. And I think that we should come to grips with that we are, no matter how we do it, one transparency task force or one progress board is not going to be enough to figure out how we can improve this institution. Third, Senator Telfer had a comment that might prove wise. She said to me that the key thing any institution needs to do is figure out how it measures success. What do you count? In this bill, at least in conversations moving forward, I think we have a chance to better hone what we count, and how we evaluate ourselves. The chair mentioned the Oregon Progress Board, which was defunded but saved without funding. I think some partnership here, and I know that in the amended version of this bill, I believe it even calls out the benchmarks to limiting and prioritizing that list. To those who say we can't bind future legislatures, I say we can recommend, we can make choices, and we can decide what we measure and how we evaluate. Next, I too have seen that list of government efficiency task forces. My thought that this task force's first task would be to assess that, think about where the gaps were and where the value added could be. I do recognize and appreciate the chair's legitimate desire to do that assessment first. I would at least, however, plead that we start it right away, because I absolutely agree with the comments already made on the record that the choices we need to make about the budget, we need to start before then. The Ways and Means system would be doing that, but if we can increase our set of tools to answer those questions, I think it will be helpful. I think there are some functions that are needlessly redundant that are brought by this bill with regard to the budgeting process, with regard to making some choices, and with regard to making some bigger picture recommendations. A binary process, and this is not, of course, new to me, a binary process is ill-suited for multilateral decisions. If somebody comes to me and says, Jeff, would you like to spend $10 billion in education? I will say yes. Right, I know that the education gap is lent to largely by what we do for richer kids in summers and don't do for poor kids. I know that if we retrofitted those buildings, we could save energy costs. I think I could spend $10 billion without wasting a penny. If somebody said, Jeff, do you want universal health care in Oregon? I would say yes. Do you understand the business development advantage it would be in this state to have a 15% savings on our on employee costs through savings in healthcare, and I could pay an employee 10% less to have the other 5%, be a huge advantage. I would say yes, but if I answer all of those questions yes, I will spend more money than we ever have. And so ultimately, the exercise of budgeting is an exercise in choices. I think increasing the number of tools we have, or at least improving those tools to make those choices, is a laudatory effort. I'm about to wrap. The next, having some consistency from session to session for our priorities and what we should measure, I think also would have some value. And if we can, through the next generation of our of one party and the next generation of our other party, if we can have some agreed upon principles and priorities about what we can do, we can continue to move forward as a state, even past the ebbs and flows of political choices of voters from session to session, as we figure out what our priorities are shared by all of our voters, or very nearly all of them. I'm sensitive to the concern that this short session is a challenging one for such a fundamental question, but these fundamental questions are very important. So I welcome Representative Thatcher's efforts. I'm glad the chair is open to those conversations. Glad you're willing to have this hearing today, and we need to continue in this task force or others and in this committee, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Next up, I have Wayne Brady and Steve Buckstein.
Chairman Holley, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Brady. I'm the chairman of the Marion County Republican Party, and I'm here to testify in support of this bill. I think it makes a big difference if you explicitly state your priorities. I know that Ways and Means probably has some implicit priorities, but I think the priorities should be explicitly stated and made public. It will make the decision-making more clear. And it will make a buy-in by the public more easy, because they can see why you're going where you're going. And when I look at the legislative process over a number of years, and I've been here as a legislative assistant, and I've been here, talking to legislators and so on, every session you have thousands of bills, or at least the regular session, and you tack on a bunch of new functions. And yet, The high priority functions, at least high priority in my mind, public safety and education, sometimes don't get the funding that they think they need, while there are a bunch of other things that do get funded. And if you prioritize these things, you may say, well, this other function is a nice thing to do if we had the money, but the high priority things we ought to be doing. And so that I really support this, and I think that Representative Wingard's idea that by doing it now, you're preparing yourself for the next session is a great point. So that's basically my position on that.
Thank you. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm with the Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. We're a nonprofit and nonpartisan public policy research organization. So rather than being a bipartisan discussion here, hopefully it's a nonpartisan or all-partisan discussion. I'm here to lend my support to this bill and this task force. And I just want to make the point that, in my view, government cannot and should not do everything, but we haven't done, as a state and citizenry and legislature, a very good job of instructing our state legislature and state agencies exactly what our priorities are. Chair Holvey, you mentioned one bill, and it was mentioned, I think, by Representative Smith about cost-efficient government, looking at how to make processes more efficient. But, and don't hold me to this because I hadn't thought about it in this testimony, but I think it was George McGovern who said in the past that you shouldn't do more efficiently what government shouldn't do at all. There are things that I think we can all think about that we wish were not done more efficiently. So that's not the whole answer to this question. The idea of this task force or something like it was really brought home to me clear back in 1997 in a hearing in this building in 1997 when Bill Scott, who was then the director of the Economic and Community Development Department, was asked by then freshman legislator Ryan Deckert what the department's highest priorities were, what their highest priority activities were. And without hesitation, Scott sat there and told him that everything his department did was high priority. Representative Decker then asked, what would he cut? What would the department cut if it got a smaller budget than they asked for? Scott shot back that he couldn't cut out anything, restating that everything was a top priority. I never forgot that exchange. I think it was sort of the starkest example of what the problem is that you're dealing with here. If everything is a top priority, then nothing is a top priority. I think this bill is a good, I was going to say first step, but obviously, as Chair Holvey said, it's not the first step, a good continuing step on this process of trying to set priorities for the legislature and for the state. I think it has the opportunity, or it is an opportunity, to make your jobs easier in the next session, as Representative Wingard and others say. You're going to have some very tough decisions to make, and the more help you have, the better, and it will be simply advisory. So I'm just here to lend my support to the idea of this task force. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and taking the time to come down here and share your points of view about that. And I'm not saying that I disagree with you entirely. I just still see, you know, a lot of our functions that are being done and are being reviewed, and I think this one of the reasons that this committee now, this is a new assignment for this committee, is government accountability, and so one of the tasks I see is trying to accomplish the very things that you're talking about going into the next session and try to figure out, you know, what kind of input our committee can have in working with Representative Smith and Representative Thatcher to take a look at where we're at and try to get our hands around it, and you know, maybe that will bring us to the next step that Representative Thatcher sees that she's ready to take right now. But frankly, I look at all the things that are out there that we're already doing on this agenda, and I also have some fundamental questions in my mind about our priorities. Are somewhat many of them laid out in the Constitution, and so you know there's a process that we have, and a Ways and Means process that that is tasked with doing many of these things right now. And so I having not sat on a Ways and Means committee, you know, I think it's important that they are in this conversation as well as we move forward. And that is a committee that's made up of people from both sides of the party, and they go through this exercise every year. And maybe we should look at the efficiency of how they do that. I don't know specifically, but I repeat, I'm very engaged in this this issue now, and I want to work on these issues and see what our committee comes up with, because that's what this committee was tasked with doing. And so I hesitate to create a task force to do just that. So I appreciate your comments and appreciate you taking your time to testify.
Representative Holley, could I ask a question?
Certainly, you can ask one.
Absent this bill, will there be someone working on this idea during the interim on a continuous basis, focusing on establishing priorities?
I think I could categorically say yes, and I think there will be more than one person working on that issue. I mean, I think I've already stated that I want to work on this issue as a committee during the interim. We have interim committee meetings, and we will start compiling, a good laundry list of what is occurring now. And I hope to be able to stay in contact with Representative Thatcher and really, you know, fully explore all these. This concept, of course, is new to this committee, and. You know, I had discussions with members from the Ways and Means Committee. I've had discussions with many legislators on this issue already to see really where should we go, whether a task force is really the correct way we should approach this, given our circumstances right now, or whether this is something we can do legislatively without engaging, the complete task force that's laid out in Representative Thatcher's bill. So I'm open to the conversation. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say the Ways and Means Committee, I think, has taken significant strides in the last, you know, I don't know how many years, but I think it was probably Kurt Schrader who read Price of Government and said, hey, there's some things we should do differently. And we started doing more priority-based budgeting. Now, for those of us who sit on Ways and Means subcommittees, you know, we do see a 10% cut list, right? You know, even if we're not going to make 10% cuts, and so legislators have tools to do that. So I can categorically say yes. I can also pledge at least, I know, two legislators and probably more who are going to be thinking about what are other structural changes we can make. I think some of the challenge is carrying some of those priorities, you know, from session to session. I think there is more focus and work we can do. How do we measure those things? So anyway, I think there's some questions need to be answered, but I do think there's some very good stuff happening.
So I appreciate your testimony. Up next, I have Art Crino, I hope I pronounced that, and Mark Higgins. Bet I got the Higgins right. I'm not sure about the Crino.
You can call me anything but late for dinner.
Well, hopefully you won't be tonight. If you would identify yourself for the record before you speak, please.
I'm Art Crino from Tigard, Oregon. I graduated from electrical engineering at Oregon State, and was hired by a large manufacturer that had 12 manufacturing facilities around the United States. I became a registered professional engineer in California and Oregon. My passion was engineering. My employer had other plans for me, and they put me in charge of one of these factories, which I looked upon with mixed emotions, because historically, when a manager became unsuitable, they didn't get demoted to their previous position or some position, they were terminated, which is, I don't think, a very pleasant experience. But I managed to avoid that for over 30 years, and the way I did it, and I believe there's a parallel with what I did to what this bill proposes. First of all, of course, I had priorities, and I assessed every project rather carefully. But once it was implemented, I monitored it. And the third thing I did was watch cash flow, which a lot of businesses simply don't understand that term. And I was able to retire when I decided to retire. And I believe there's a parallel here. I'd like to encourage you to adopt it. Granted, I was dealing with millions of dollars. You're dealing in larger numbers. But hopefully there is a relationship. I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Hi, Mark Higgins, and a resident of Newburgh and president of Point Monitor Corporation in Beaverton, a low-voltage systems company. With respect to Representative Thatcher's approach, as I understand it, in some ways I think it's the most important question that is before the legislature at this time. It sounds like it's an ongoing question. I give my full support as a citizen and as a business owner. I hope your committee will recognize the timeliness of this question and appreciate Representative Thatcher's and Smith's leadership in promoting it. And I've already heard some positive things from Chair Holvey. That's encouraging. Before talking about prioritizing in business, and I think my comments are probably 2 minutes total, you know, personally in our family, just like every family, we have to do some prioritizing. We have to put our needs over our wants and the things at hand over maybe our dreams. I believe every responsible family does this. And we're constantly evaluating our spending habits to judge whether or not they're sustainable, which I think is a key question here. From a business perspective, sustainability, again, is a fundamental consideration for me and how I run my business. At my company, payroll, taxes, insurance, those are the number one short-term priorities, and I never let any, they're not core functions really, but on the other hand, I never let any discretionary expenditures get ahead of those things because I just can't. For example, you know, there have been times where I've delayed replacing a service van or even skipped my own paycheck to make sure that I could make my payroll. We never borrow money we may borrow money to fund capital or tools, but never to fund losses. We cut. We have to, and that's how a business has to survive. From your state perspective, I'm new to this, but this caught my attention. With regard to this thought process for budgeting, I'm extremely appreciative of the effort and to identify and prioritize core functions. I think it's a fabulous idea. I believe it's wise and necessary, and I think the ultimate goal should be to perform the core functions well and at the minimum cost to the taxpayers. And finally, and I think this might be a new point to be made, focusing more on core functions and achieving efficiency through prioritization will bring back dignity and self-respect for state workers. There's pressure. People are talking about, what about all the government workers? And be it teachers, highway patrol, or many busy individuals here in Salem, I think, you know, they're trying to conduct business on our behalf, and it's a distraction. Are we going to lose our jobs? Are people thinking that we're dead weight? And that's not the case. I think that this constant and unnecessary expansion into non-critical functions, in my opinion, it causes budget crunches, finger-pointing, and then ultimately undue scrutiny on government workers that maybe they're the problem when that's not the case. So in closing, I believe there's no better time to address the question. I hope this discussion will gain momentum and support, and it sounds like it might. I think it's the right thing to do, and I'm sure that we have before us an opportunity to transform our state and focus on priorities. I look forward to a positive debate, and I'm glad you're talking about it. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today, and I really do appreciate you coming and giving us your point of view on this. I am looking at a document, and you know, it kind of makes me think about this whole thing in a different light, because we have done a lot of things, and there was an advisory committee on government performance and accountability that did a report in 2004, and it looked at aligning our priorities and our core functions. And so I think there's been a lot of work done in this area, and I think it's this committee's charge to take a look at those recommendations to see where we're at today, and what have we implemented out of those recommendations, and if we haven't implemented all of them, why not? And so I think that you know, as much as it seems like that I'm not engaged in this particular bill, I think this bill has definitely brought to my attention that as charged with this new area of government accountability, that we look at what we've already done. We've already studied a lot of these things, and we've already had reports on these things, and rather than have a task force do it all over again. And I know that that's not the only purpose of the task force, that the task force could probably compile these things too, but I feel compelled that this committee can do that, and I think we have a good, diverse committee to offer all the different perspectives and engage Representative Thatcher in doing this this interim. And you know, who knows where that will take us, but I think it will help our conversation going forward. I certainly think that you know, our Ways and Means process has a lot of folks that go through this, you know, you know, I need to engage them as well as to, you know, how they identify priorities and bring it to us, which we all end up voting on those priorities every session, you know, when we vote on our budgets. So I really appreciate this conversation and do remain committed to the topic. So thank you very much for your testimony. Comments from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take this opportunity. You keep talking about, you know, it's a new function for the committee, but it's not a new function for Representative Thatcher and I. We sat on government accountability last session, and we did do some good work together. Representative Thatcher was the first new representative that I met in orientation when we both were new at this, and we've worked together on some good things since then. Her aide and I have worked together even before we were down here. We worked together on the Legislative Issues Committee for the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, and I appreciate her work on this as well. I think that this is a good, very good thing for us to be looking at, and that we need to, if we're not going to do this now, we need to continue looking at it, and I'm willing to be part of that conversation. I want to work with Representative Thatcher again on this issue, and I hope we can go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, and there's no more public testimony today?
Nope.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to apologize. I had to step out of the room briefly, but I know that a lot of you came here on your own time, and thank you very much for coming down to this important issue. I just want to kind of reflect on just a couple things. We, earlier today in Business and Labor, of which Representative Thatcher and I sit on, we had another task force that was proposed that we would look forward to, and that task force had a fiscal that was perhaps between $35,000 to $50,000, roughly. And that's going to move forward, but there it is again in real dollars of $50,000 for a task force. I would also recommend that we might look at the Veterans Affairs, because last year, or perhaps the 2007 legislation, had elected to move forward the Veterans Task Force. What this committee did was they went throughout the 36 counties of Oregon, and they came back with this very comprehensive package for our veterans. It was important because these are citizen soldiers. Off to war, coming home here very soon. And we realized that while we had some parades going, we needed more policies in place. And the bottom line was those recommendations came forward, of which we serve, Representative Riley and several others on the committee, brought forward the most comprehensive package that we passed for veterans in a very long time, if not in the history of the state. Proud of that. So I do think there's legitimacy to having this core function study. I think sometimes it's ironic if it's redundant and we're studying things that we're already doing, it could be seen as maybe we're not really studying the core functions we should be. But I think the conversation to look into it, definitely important. I think the money, there will be a fiscal attached to it. 11 members of the legislation, I would propose, would be a bipartisan group. I would recommend they go throughout the state and do and follow the model of the Veterans Task Force, because quite honestly, it's citizen input that matters. And it's not citizen input from Gresham, where I represent, but it's citizen input from Gresham and all other districts. And that's very important. So those are my comments. For the record, Mr. Chair, I'm supportive of this concept. I do hope this conversation does continue. I get why fiscals and indeterminate fiscals are difficult for us, particularly now, but I sure hope that doesn't end up hamstringing us to where we just get off the idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments, again, I appreciate the testimony today and close the public hearing on House Bill 3614. Patrick, I believe that our committee right now has moved out several bills, and we have up Thursday. We have carried over a few more. If you'd repeat those for me, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tomorrow we will have before the committee carried over from today House Bill 3699, which we heard but did not move, and House Bill 3615, which we heard previously, and House Bill 3624, which we also heard previously.
Thank you. Committee, we stand adjourned.